Tomorrow night, we are not on. We'll resume, God willing, Thursday night, just a one-night break. And tonight, so now, does everyone here get the list that was sent out? Or not? Okay, so, Sugya, on Dafayin Ches Amud Aleph. Again, like we said yesterday about the Sugya right before it, it's not particularly Polim relevant any more than anything else, but it has a lot of Halacha L'maisa relevance, and just how much depends on how much you want to give it. It's a matter of major debate, and it could come up in a lot of contexts, but one of the reasons it's been discussed prominently in the past few years is because of its potential relevance. It's a topic of debate, but its potential relevance to the question of intellectual property. So maybe before we talk about what the Gemara says and discuss anything in it, just to say a few words about that, and then we'll come back to this. So there is a major question in general, to what extent the halacha recognizes the concept of intellectual property, and to what extent it's identical or is it different from the way current secular conceptions would view it. The truth is that you don't really have a straight answer to that question, right? If we talk about the concept of stealing intellectual property, so there's a lot of room to wonder how exactly that fits. Nowadays, it's a topic of particular relevance because not only is the question was asked even just a few years ago about copying tapes or copying computer programs, but now things can be so easily downloaded from the internet, the question becomes, again, is there really an applicability of the idea of gezeila in that context? And the fact that the artists, the creators, the producers would like it to be perceived that way is understandable. They definitely have a vested interest, but it doesn't necessarily attach that way just because they want it to be. So if they make a commercial or whatever, they say that if you're going to illegally download movies, it's theft. Maybe yes, maybe no, but it's not going to become theft necessarily just because they want it to be theft. You know, they have an interest in it being considered theft. So we have to figure out, first of all, even just philosophically, outside of the concept of halacha, is there a proper terminology in that case? Is that really what's going on? Well, why would it not be called theft? Why would you maybe hesitate to call what's commonly called theft of intellectual property theft in an actual sense? And whether you want to use halachic terminology or not, what's missing perhaps from the definition of theft?
You didn't physically steal it.
So you don't physically steal something, so that's one ingredient that's missing. And by physically, what do you mean? You're doing something, right? You push a button. What do you mean by physically? What's lacking?
You didn't take it from them.
You didn't remove it, so I have to be very specific with your language, right? You didn't physically take it from one place to another, and especially that you didn't leave them without it, right? Normally, if I steal something, if I'm going to steal your phone over there, so I pick it up, I take it to me, I have it, and you don't have it. So that basic structure is missing in the context of downloading some type of intellectual product. So if that's the case, you know, it's not to say, it's important to emphasize, just because it's easy to get the wrong idea, it's not to say that if we call it something other than theft, that it's mutter. It's not to say that it's okay or that it's moral. The question is just, what is the proper terminology? So whether or not that's called theft is maybe open to question from that perspective. So is there, you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, the first reasoning, I don't fully understand, though, because, for example, let's say someone has an online bank account, so you didn't move the money, I guess, from one place to another, but, you know, like, with a push of a button, you also transferred money from one location.
But you certainly made it missing in the other guy's account. Which
right,
is
so
that's
this
idea
reason
for that.
Would, right.
But that's pretty significant. You know, that's really, you did something to cause. Now, the mechanics of contemporary finance is worthy of a discussion of itself. So how exactly you did it a little bit of a remove, but the result is the same, that you end up with this person's funds and he ends up without them. So in that way, it's completely comparable.
So the second reason is applicable, but the first
But it's
one
both halves of the occasion. There's a certain object, right, or its value in terms of money, which is now added to your assets and subtracted from somebody else's assets. So in that way, it's completely comparable to a traditional theft. It's, well, here you have an intellectual property, the object's not really moved at all. Right? The object does not in any way stop being where it is and is not missing to its original owner.
The ability to cash in on it, though, is kind
of... Ah, correct. So yes, you're certainly depriving the person, or not certainly, it depends on the circumstance, but you're very possibly depriving the person of potential profit. Now, the problem is, and again, and you feel like I have to emphasize this, don't assume that I'm saying that it's okay if it's not theft. That doesn't necessarily make it theft. Not everything that you do that stops someone from profiting is necessarily or is even remotely called theft. There's all kinds of things I could do which would stop you from profiting in a way that you would normally expect. Some of them would be called something else, some other type of avera. Maybe they'd be called mazik, maybe. And some of them might not even be out of the realm of acceptable behavior. Let's say, for example, if I compete with you in business. So sometimes competition, we know, can be, it's also sugyas in the Gemara here and elsewhere, that some competition is legitimate and some competition is questionable. But it's not necessarily the case that competition right off the bat is considered stealing. Right? So if I have a product that I'm competing with yours, so then I'll also be making it less likely that people are going to buy your product. Doesn't necessarily make me into a thief. Right, the fact that I'm denying you, or what if I invent something else which makes your project, or makes your product obsolete? Or what if I badmouth your product? So it's lashon hara. So okay, so it could be an aveira, or maybe I badmouth your product, the toelis. No, well, maybe we decide that it's mutter the way I'm badmouthing your product. All kinds of things I could do that will result in your not cashing in the way you expect to. Maybe it's comparable to theft, maybe it's not, maybe it's not even usher. You know, we don't necessarily know automatically that that causes a problem. And something we also discussed a little bit during the semester, that there is somewhat of a distance here, that if you actually do something to illegitimately cause somebody to miss out on his potential profit, so then that's generally called a grum of an azikin in most cases, depending on how it's done. And therefore, normally the rule is for grum of an azikin is that it might be prohibited to do. It often is prohibited to do. But it's usually the case that the person who does it is pater, that you can't collect in bezdin based on this loss because it's hard to... Well, number, I don't want to say what the reason is because there's a little bit of discussion what the reason is, but essentially that's something that you can't necessarily collect for after the fact. So all of this is just speculation, is to say that it's not 100% clear, whatever terminology people would like to use today, it's not 100% clear that theft really is the right usage. Now, if you want to say that theft really is the right word, so then you presumably have to have a philosophical conception, which is not completely impossible, that really sees a physical, that really sees an intellectual creation as a physical creation, and therefore, to whatever extent you're appropriating it, you find that somehow broadly within the definition of theft. But it's a little bit of a stretch. But there are those who feel that that's the proper way to view things, that it is somehow an expanded way of calling something theft. Hi.
Yeah, just to clarify one more time, what were the two basic things within theft that you're removing
well,
something
normally,
from the person?
Yeah, normally when you steal something, you take it away from them and you have it, and they don't.
And they don't.
Right, so there's a physical object which you pick up. And
does it have to be something tangible? Or?
Well, that's how we normally assume. So now to extend it into intellectual, untangible property, it's not impossible, but it's a chiddush, right? It's not so clear that that fits into the traditional definition of what's been called theft.
So back to the online bank account example, is that considered, would that fall into the category of theft?
Yeah, because the end result, again, is that actual monetary value has been removed.
So that is considered tangible.
Yeah, you're doing it in a non-traditional way. It's not clear if that should matter so much. The fact is the end result is you're taking actual dollars and moving it away from him, and it's no longer in his bank account, and it is in your bank account, so the end result is very comparable to traditional theft. It's just done in a modern way. So whether or not theft is the right way to look at things is a little bit of an open question. So then that leaves you with two possibilities. If you essentially have, I think, just speculating again outside of halacha for a moment, really three different ways to look at how theft relates to intellectual property, or how taking, appropriating somebody else's intellectual property should be classified. Either you want to call it theft, and you're not bothered by these questions, and you feel that you can expand the category to include these types of non-tangible situations, or you don't feel that way, so then you have two other possibilities. One possibility will say, okay, therefore it's mutter, it's acceptable, because it doesn't fall into a existing category, and that may not seem right to us, and good reason why it may not seem right. And if it's not moral or legal or mutter, so then we have to find some other way of understanding what the issue is. So what other possibilities do we have? If we want to say that there's something wrong with doing this, but it's not actual theft because the definitions don't really match, so what is it? We don't want to try to hazard a guess. What else could it be? What's wrong with it? Hi?
Maybe it's against Dina
de Malchus Adina. So Dina de Malchus Adina is definitely an element. So there are those who invoke that. Right? That certainly in contemporary society there are laws that regulate this. And that's something, for example, the Beis Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak Shmelkis, writes in his Tshuvas that that's the issue, that Dina de Malchus Adina, that we live in a society where this is regulated. So certainly when dealing with non-Jews, for example, so you assume that Dina de Malchus Adina will regulate the relationship between Jews and non-Jews because they don't have a Shulchan Aruch. But even just dealing with Jews, you probably also have a good case to make that Dina de Malchus Adina is going to be relevant. Now, when you're talking about Dina de Malchus Adina and the laws here, it is interesting to point out that, again, you have these same questions within secular law as well. And it's not so crazy to say that you could come up with a situation like the following. It's not so crazy to say that really it's not theft, because we're lacking the ingredients of theft. And we're not even sure what the actual prohibition is. But at the same time, we can't allow it because it will destroy the market for intellectual products. If we believe that it's in the interest of society to have innovation and to have art and literature and inventions and Chiddushei Torah and books written and the like, so then people are not going to do this if they know that they can't profit off it because they're too vulnerable. They'll work to make whatever they make, and then they have no protection against it being utilized by everyone without any kind of compensation. So it's not so crazy to say that, therefore, society, l'takanas hatzibur, has made up laws to address that problem. So both within halacha you find such possibilities, that you find throughout the history of the halachic literature, you find a cherem put into place. For example, you find that the tzibur has decided to, so to speak, curse someone who appropriates somebody else's writings. There's kind of extra legal maneuvers that are put in to encourage or to strongly discourage, on the other hand, people from appropriating other people's intellectual output. Because we know that if we don't have some kind of protection, so no one's going to produce anything. It's not worth the effort. So, for example, if you look at American law in the realm of copyrights and trademarks and patents, so you have a little bit of a balance, because on the one hand, there is a little bit of a feeling that this is not actual property, and patents and the like, and copyrights and trademarks expire, they have to be renewed, that there is a certain amount to which they are the property of the public. But society has imposed a structure upon it where there is some measure of protection so that people who labor in these fields can be encouraged to do so because they're going to have some profit protected. So it's possible to say that, listen, this doesn't necessarily fit into any existing category, moral or halachic category, and society has made laws because they need to, they want to have a flourishing intellectual market. They want to have art and literature and innovation and invention and medical advances. And therefore, we create structures so that the people who labor in these fields can expect a certain amount of protection, but it's essentially artificial. Essentially, it's a construct that the Tzibor, both the Jewish Tzibor and the non-Jewish Tzibor, has created this in order to protect these industries. And that's not such a crazy thing to say. So especially if you feel that you're resorting to Dina D'Malchus Adina in kind of a default mode, that there isn't anything else that you feel actually covers this, so then that might reflect such a possibility, which is no less binding, but it just says a little bit about how this is operating. Hi.
So the Rabbanan did set up these gederos for us taking intellectual property?
You do find in the history of the halachic literature definitely charamim put into place in various eras,
right,
that somebody who's going to publish somebody else's sefer without their permission, for example, you know, we're not taking anything physically away from them, but he's going to decide, okay, you wrote a sefer, I'm going to publish and sell it. So there's a lot of literature about that, and including in recent generations also, there's been a major Dinei Torah, you know, major cases where somebody wants to publish somebody else's chidushim, who has the rights to do it, to a family member, et cetera, et cetera. So Batei Din have gotten involved, and the language is not always a language of existing sugya. Sometimes it's just a recognition that we need to impose certain protections in order to have a market in this realm which is going to succeed. So Dina Malchus Adina, in other words, yes, is a valid approach, and it is an approach that Poskim have adopted, but to say that might mean that you don't have a better answer. It might mean that you don't think it's theft and you don't think it's anything in between, and essentially society has taken measures in order to impose order upon the system. So you think there's anything in between, anything else that might possibly address this? So it could also be. So then you'll start off with the idea that it strikes you as wrong, right? This is somewhere in the middle, right? But that one who has a sense of yashrus, as the Ramban expresses in his commentary to Chumash on that pasuk. So how could it be that somebody else labors to create this and you could just take it for yourself and have equal or even greater ability to make profit than to deprive him of his ability to make profit? Even if I can't point to a specific issur or call that theft, it certainly seems morally wrong. And therefore, perhaps that should be enough to create an issur. That's simply immoral, because we can see that there is clearly a disparity here between the effort and the person who's benefiting from the effort, and them clearly depriving somebody of the yigiyas kapo. So it would seem to be, just in a moral sense, would tell us it's wrong, and that, as the Ramban writes in Chumash, that's a violation of Yasisa Yashur V'Hatov. So that's also a possibility. I think that's, in a sense, it's stronger than Dina Malchus Adina, in the sense that we're not necessarily saying that we can't come up with anything else. We're saying that we do feel that it's not just for the protection of the Tzibor, but there's something morally wrong here. And that is the way many read the Shol Lameshiv. The Shol Lameshiv is one of the great poskim in history, Rios Shol Nathanson, who wrote roughly a trillion tshuvas. If you look at it, it has these huge volumes of tshuvas, Shol Lameshiv. Each one has many volumes in it. There's Madura Kama, Madura Tinyana, Tlisa. Each one starts all over again, and each one is a very small print. He has a quadrillion tshuvas. So he was a major, major posek. So he has a tshuva about this, where he essentially stipulates that this is the case, that there's got to be intellectual property protection. We never could imagine any other such way. So he's not explicit like this, but there are some who say that he means it in a moral sense. He means it like in the sense of Yasisa Hayashur V'Hatov, and that's enough to explain it. And that is expressed that way by the Hisoyrus Tshuva. Hisoyrus Tshuva was a descendant of Rav Akiva Eger and Nachsam Sofer. His name was Eger Sofer. So, and he has a tshuva. He also asserts this way, that Al Tzvasisa Yashur V'Hatov. So that's enough to make this to be the case, to express that it's essentially immoral to act in any other such way. And then, of course, you also have the fact that if not only is logic pointing in this direction, but if society has decided, you know, that society is calling you Gezel, so the fact that we don't necessarily feel that it meets, or we may not necessarily feel that it matches the actual definition of Gezel, but it's certainly Achil Hashem, it's certainly Yashav HaTov, that if the society you're living in has determined that something is Gezel, so you're not going to want to act anything less than that. You're not going to want to treat it as anything less than Gezel, even if intellectually you wouldn't have come to the same conclusion, certainly, else Kiddush Hashem, and presumably also a degree of V'yasisa Hayasha V'hatov. So that's a reasonable possibility as well. What else might be a possibility? Any other thoughts? Well, so let's ask it another way. There are a couple of other possibilities, but before we won't try to exhaust everything before looking at the Gemara. But let's introduce our Gemara now with this following question. Let's say that I don't necessarily have an automatic protection, but the artist, the creator, whatever it is, the producer, has something at his disposal by which he can impose such protection. What would that be? Is there any such thing? If I want to sell you a tape of my band playing music, and I don't want you to copy the tape, right? So either I could make a commercial where I tell everyone it's Gezel, it's Gneva, it's whatever it is. Maybe you won't believe me. So maybe the law will back me up, maybe it won't. Is there anything within halacha that I can do to impose a requirement upon you that you're not going to tape? So it probably comes, well, you're not going to copy it. So it probably comes to mind first, and which is often invoked, is the concept of a tanai. You might think, okay, why can't I sell this to you al tanai? I'll sell it on condition that you're not going to copy it. And that maybe I should have the right to say such a thing, that I'm not selling this to you in a blanket kind of way, but the same way we find throughout halacha, there's often a concept of tanai in many different contexts, where you can do something on an express condition. So should I be able to sell you this on a condition? Say that this is the condition under which I'm selling it to you, and therefore I can tell you what to do. So is that going to do it for us? What do you think? Is that a valid kind of approach? So it has weaknesses to it. Among the weaknesses, from a halachic perspective specifically, is that we have rules for tanaim. We have a mishpate tanaim that you have to have, for example, what's called a tanai kafel. Like the Gemara says, it has to be like the tanai of Bnei Gad and Bnei Ruvain. You have to have all the conditions spelled out, that if you do it this way, it's good. If you do it that way, it's not good. So generally, the conditions that are placed in sales don't really follow those rules. But there's also something more fundamental, that if you think it through, this is something the Poskim have been very concerned about, that let's say I sell you a book, and I say, I'm selling you the book on condition you don't make a copy of it. So then what happens if you do make a copy of it? Then what?
Is the sale canceled?
So let's say it's canceled. So then what happens? So now what's the next step?
Does it become Gneiva?
Well, not necessarily, because you could then go to the store and say, okay, I violated the condition. I copied the book. So what happens? I guess the sale is negated. So now I'll give you back your book. You give me back my money. So what happens? This Avarian, right, this guy who's some kind of criminal here, apparently, he ends up with his money back, and he gets his free copy of the book that he made. And maybe he made 10 copies. So that's not really to the benefit of the seller. But that would be the logical conclusion of a conditional sale. So it's not, and that's the way many poskim understand it, it's not really so clear that that's the mechanism that's going to do it, that tanai is a problematic tool, as much as you sometimes find that in writing, both in halachic language and in secular language, on these products, but it's questionable whether or not that's really going to be the proper mechanism in order to protect your rights here. So the question is, can our Gemara and Ayin Ches and Aleph help at all? So I don't know if you got a chance to see the Gemara, again, whether either, if you're looking at the Mar Makomos or going straight ahead, either way, it would be good to have seen Ayin Ches and Aleph. Where the Gemara has a din, what's the din the Gemara has here, the Mishnah and the Gemara has a din, where it talks about, let's say you rent out an animal to somebody. and there are terms to the rental. Right? The Mishnah says, "Asaycher as a chamor lo alicho bahar v alicho bebika." Bebika v alicho bahar. Let's say you rented out a donkey, and the deal was that he could use the donkey on the mountain, and instead he used it in the valley, or the other way around. You told him he could use it in the valley, and instead he used it in the mountain. And even if they were equal distances, but v'mesa, the animal dies, so then the person who rented it is liable. Now, normally, if you use an animal the way it's meant to be used, and you rent it, mesa machmas malacha, you should be pater. So what's the idea here that you should be chayim? So the Gemara eventually suggests that perhaps this is an expression of the view of Reb Meir. And the last line of Ayin Chesem and Aleph, the Gemara introduces this concept, the kolamaver al das shabal habayis nikra gazlin, that whoever deviates from the instruction of the balabas, of the master, however you want to interpret it in this context, is called a gazlin. And the Gemara gives some examples about this, which maybe we'll get to express a little bit more, some interesting ramifications in the area of tzedaka. So, for example, if you give a coin to a poor person and say, this comes up all the time in various formats, you say, buy a shirt, buy a chaluk, and he instead buys a cloak, he buys a talis, so then he's doing something wrong. According to Reb Meir's view, he's nikra gazlan. So the question is, first of all, to take note of the fact that it's a machlokas in the Gemara, right? According to Reb Meir, he's called a gazlan, and according to Chachamim, it's something else. We don't know exactly what it is according to Chachamim. But what is this Gemara telling us? You could probably see a couple of different ways to understand this Gemara. But just things that you pick up right away is, first of all, there is a machlokas on the point whether it's true or not. So what is Reb Meir's position and what is Chachamim's position? And what does Reb Meir mean when he says Nikra Gazlan? Does he mean it's literally a Gazlan? Does he mean it's called a gazlan? Does it have all the rules of gazela? What is this Gemara talking about? What's this Gemara tapping into here? So, you could have said it's a tanai, like we just talked about. That maybe there are circumstances where you make a tanai, and therefore the renter, or the ani, or whoever it is obligated to follow the condition. But not necessarily as blatant as the problem we mentioned a minute ago, but as Rishonim point out, you really have to have Tanoim that are explicit following the rules of Tanoim, unless you want to say the situations are so super obvious it's a complete Anan Sadi that anyone who's looking can tell you that those are the conditions, but that's not necessarily a reading that really fits in with this Gemara. So what exactly, what is this din about? What is happening here? What is the power of Vermeer's position? Hi.
Does the Gemara suggest that it's a pshia? Because clearly the animal's not equipped to handle these other conditions.
It doesn't sound like it, because, I mean, it may be that that's what the other person can claim, right? That if I gave it to you with this in mind, then there's some issue with that, with A versus B, that caused this to happen. But normally speaking, if you had taken the animal without any kind of stipulation, the understanding would have been this would have been a total normal usage. So what's driving the chiyuv is clearly the deviation from what the renter, what the balabayas wants.
So it could have been go right or go left. It didn't have to be a valley and mountain.
Right, except that as the Rishonim explain and the Gemara explains, the Rishonim spell out that valley could have said that it's too hot up in the mountain, and the valley it's too cold. There are elements he could point to. But whatever it is, it emanates from the fact that it's a deviation from what the...
That's the key. Okay.
Right. So, had he not said anything, it would have been perfectly normal. That's what the Mishnah says. They're both the same distance, and it would have been a Mesa Machmos Malacha kind of situation. So, what exactly is the nature of this din? So, this din was discussed at great length by one of the Gedolim of this era, Reb Zalman Nechemi Goldberg Shlita, in a very often quoted article that was printed in the journal Tchumen. in the sixth volume of Tchumen, Rav Zalman Nechemia has an article where he analyzes what this din is, and where he explains right off the bat that it's not a Tanai for various reasons, but it's something else. And it's something that he thinks is highly relevant to the intellectual property consideration. So he essentially suggests, based on this sugya, that there is a concept, I mean, this concept exists elsewhere, but it's a concept that's being invoked here and that's relevant in the intellectual property context as well, of shiur. Right? Shiur meaning not shiur like now, shiur without an ayin, shin yud vav resh, that you are leaving something out, like tanavishir, when the Gemara says that the Mishnah lists some things and left out other things, so that you could sell something in a less than absolute way. That you could sell something and hold on to some aspect of it for yourself. Now, again, this is a concept that exists. You can find it elsewhere. I put in the more expanded Marakomas that I sent out today. So you can take a look over there. For example, there's a Gemara in Bava Basra and Samach Gimel Amar Aleph, where the Gemara talks about somebody who's renting out a house but wants to maintain certain rights for himself within the house that he's renting to somebody else. And perhaps one could say that the owner here is renting out or selling an item to some extent, but is holding back some rights for himself. And building on that model, Reb Zalman Nechemia suggests that perhaps this could be utilized as well by somebody selling a book, a tape, a computer program, whatever, that he could do so and say, I'm selling you this item, but I am holding on to the right to copy it. I'm not giving you that. I'm only giving it to you partially. He takes note that this sounds a little bit like a Gemara Nedarim, which is also on today's updated version. There's a Gemara in the end of Parak HaShut and Daf Mem Ches in Nedarim, which sounds a little bit like this, but he points out that it's not really. Where the Gemara talks about somebody who has some property that he would have passed on to his son, but he doesn't trust his son, so he doesn't want to give it to his son. And somebody said to him, but maybe your grandson will be trustworthy, so maybe you should keep it within the family so that your grandson will be a person who's deserving. So the question was discussed there, can this person pass on to his son only the right to pass on the item to the grandson, but nothing else? And is that perhaps comparable to this? You're kind of not actually giving an item over totally, you're holding back certain rights. So he doesn't think that's actually comparable. If you look around over there, explains that the person never actually receives the item there at all. He just receives only the right to transmit it to a third party. And that's maybe less than this. But maybe our Gemara here is saying that you can sell something or you can rent something, and essentially it's going to be a... Essentially it's going to be a incomplete sale or rental, that there are aspects that are being held back by the owner. And he contrasts this with an understanding of the Ktos. The Ktos has a little bit of a different spin on these Gemaras, that we have a concept in Halacha in general called Tovas Hana. Right? So let's say, for example, a person has Truma to give, or he has Meiser to give. So that food he can't eat himself anyway. He's got to give it to the Kohen, he's got to give it to Levi, he's got to give it to whoever else, somebody other than him. So if a Kohen or a Levi would decide to grab it away from him, he's not really depriving him of any value because this food has to go to the Kohen Levi anyway. But he is depriving him of something called Tova Sana. Tova Sana meaning that he has a certain amount of discretion and control in deciding which Kohen, which Levi, which cause he's going to give it to. And if you deprive the person of that value, so that's something. It's a Tova Sana is being taken away. So the Gemara has a machlokus in general. Do you say Tova Sana is mammon, it has monetary value, or do you say it doesn't have monetary value? So the Ktos understands that's more what's going on here, that this amount of control the person is holding on to, and you're depriving him of that by not following his instructions, It's basically comparable to taking away his Tova Sana, and it all ties into the question of whether Tova Sana is money or not. So Rav Zalman Nechemi has a different approach. He doesn't really think that's the right kind of language. He thinks that what's going on here is that this is an example of shiur, you're holding back some aspect of the sale, and that the seller has the right to do that. And that even Chachamim would agree to some extent. That Reb Meir would go so far as to say, you're Nikra Gazlan. Chachamim would also agree there's something wrong. It's not necessarily called Gzela. And maybe also Chachamim would agree more if it was more explicit. But that they don't disagree in an absolute sense with Reb Meir's din. That's how he assumes.
Just again, what did the Chachamim say again?
So, we don't really know Chachamim's expressed position. We know that they don't agree with Reb Meir. So there's some difference between Kol overall Das Balabayis Nikra Gazlin and Chachamim. But does that mean that they think it's Mutter Lagamri? Does that mean there's no circumstance where they would think that there is some kind of binding clause on them? Zalman Nechemi thought not necessarily. So this is Zalman Nechemi's basic position, that there is this ability of the seller to essentially stop the purchaser from using the item in this way, in a way that he doesn't want it to. And therefore, that would have certain implications, such as possibly being akin to gezeila, if somebody would violate this. So just kind of the agenda. We're going to run out of time in a few minutes. I think Meiriv now, it's 2 blocks away. Mincha, Meiriv, Mincha is 2 blocks away. I have a little more time for it. But our plan is to always be finished by Mincha. Mincha is 8:10 this week, I think. So we'll finish in a few minutes. There'll be a little bit left. There'll be some significant other points to make. We haven't even mentioned some of the other theories. So we'll have to continue this a little bit on Thursday, and then we'll also talk a little bit about the Parsha, hopefully. But we'll continue this topic. But just to kind of sketch out the basic outline here, so this was Rav Zalman Nechemi's Shita LaHalacha, that one who, if the seller makes it clear that this is what he wants, so then he can sell it that way, and the purchaser is going to be bound to it. Possibly in a type of gzela, possibly some other type of offense. There's a whole other model, which he mentions, which we didn't get up to yet, the Od Bihuda, so remind, we'll have to mention Od Bihuda on Thursday, and there's yet another model we could bring in. We haven't talked about, we have a couple of other possibilities to also include in this equation, but this was Rav Zalman Nechemi's big position. So many did not accept this. Many did not agree that this was true. And they felt that the concept of shiur means that there's some type of actual physical aspect that you're holding back. But to say some kind of abstract right is difficult to assume that there is such an ability. This is a point that Rabbi Willig took issue with. He doesn't agree that this chiddush is true. And there was an article in Tchum in the next volume by Naftali Bar Ilan where he expresses a number of objections to this position. So just to kind of sketch out the highlights of what he thinks is wrong about this, he says, first of all, just in terms of the big picture, so he says there's always been, for many centuries, a discussion about intellectual property. And you have two ways of looking at it, those who think that it's not really protected, and those who have said it's protected for other reasons. But why don't they say it's protected because of this? So he says that itself, he feels, is a little bit of a weakness in the position. But the other major weakness, and again this is before getting into the details of the concept, is you think about the implications, right, that sellers could put all kinds of limitations that would really be very, very inhibiting of normal usage. And do we grant them that right also? So let's say, for example, you have a guy who sells cars and he wants to sell twice as many cars. So he says, when I sell you your car, you can only use it on Sunday, Tuesday, and Thursday. And you want to drive on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, you got to buy another car for that. So is that legitimate? Does he have the right to do that? And do we have such a construct that you could sell an item and then tell, after you've sold it, told the other party what he can and can't do with it? So there were those who found that to be an impossibility. How could it be that should work, that you're going to sell it and you're still going to retain that kind of control on an ongoing basis. You know, it's not necessarily comparable to the case where you gave the owner the dinar and he spent it on something else. You know, at least that's somewhat contained. And, for example, in Rav Bar-Ilan's articles, he says he could think of a different model to apply this whole Gemara, that you could say that there is no kinyan until the condition is fulfilled in this case. So let's say, for example, when you give the money to the ani to buy a shirt, you could say that it's basically considered to be borrowed money in his hands until he spends it on a shirt. Then once he does, he is kona the coin. And then it's over. You don't have to keep the relationship forever. But to say that that's a model that's going to work for when you're selling a book, it's a lot harder to say. And he says over there, that article, he says, so everyone would sell books and say you can't give it to a library. And say when you're finished, you can't give it to your family members. Nobody does that, right? It's not a viable system. So he doesn't think that this is really true. And he and others have argued against the Shiur model being applicable to intellectual property in general, and being applicable to the idea that I can sell you an item and say I can then still control your life in terms of what you do with it. Now, the truth is, even if you accept the Shiur model, it doesn't really help everybody. It won't address all the intellectual property problems because it will only, ironically, it's only going to address people who legitimately buy the first copy. It's not going to help the internet issue that's developed now, where it's a question of downloading something kind of illegitimately in the first place. Although there is such a discussion to be had that somebody is basically, in Reb Zalman Lechemi's model, somebody along the way is doing this Nikra Gzela, and the question is, can you benefit from the other person's Nikra Gzela, or are you exacerbating the problem? But ironically, on the surface, the issue is really most addressed to somebody who did the legitimate act to begin with. Somebody legitimately buys the book or the tape. So then you can start getting into this discussion that when he bought it, did he also accept a limitation not to copy it or to distribute it that way. But if you don't buy it in the first place, then it's even harder to say that this whole discussion is going to be relevant to you. Except to the extent that you're dealing with someone who did, and then you could bring that question up. So it's a little bit of a complex model to try to invoke in this context. So we have to see, are there other ways to address this question, and what do they possibly also reflect in terms of understanding the sugya? What is the impact of the sugya? So we have a little bit more to finish. We're not really finished with this, but just to quickly review what we spoke about. So we discussed this question of intellectual property in general, the question of, is it true that if you take somebody's intellectual property, you're stealing? So we said that there is a little bit of ambiguity there, that on the one hand doesn't seem to really match the details of what's involved in theft of a physical item. So you could really go three ways. Either you could say that in Hanami it's still an expansion of the concept of theft despite the problems, or you could say that it's not, and therefore maybe you think it's okay, or no, you don't think it's okay, you have to figure out why there's some other reason why it's okay, so why it's not okay. So what are the reasons were possibilities? So it was suggested, for example, Dina Malchus Adina, which, like the Beis Yitzchak sets forward, could certainly be a very strong possibility and certainly would be a big major player here, but in a sense it's a little bit of a last resort, because that basically means you have no other reason to assert it, and that even the fact that the law makes the laws the way they do may reflect the fact that it's not inherently something that fits into any other type of offense, but that it's a protection society and halacha is imposing in order to allow intellectual property to be created in the first place. And then there was a question of, does it perhaps fall under V'yasisa Yashar V'hatov, which might be what the Sholem Meshuv was getting at, and might be, and is what the Sar Shuvah was getting at, which means that you basically suspect there is a moral issue here. We're not 100% sure what other existing Pasuk or Din covers it, but certainly from a moral perspective, it certainly seems wrong, and therefore V'yasisa Yashar V'hatov will come in to address that. And then we pushed aside some other issues to then get to our Gemara. We discussed the question of whether a Tanai, if to focus specifically on a scenario where somebody sells an item that he doesn't want to have it copied and distributed to others, what control could he have So Tanai comes to mind first. We mentioned Tanai has its weaknesses because besides the fact that the halacha requires Tanaim to be expressed in a certain way, but also just in terms of its structure, what's the downside of the Tanai? Does it mean that you're going to have the sale negated? If that will generally be to the disadvantage of the seller. It's not what he's going to want anyway, so that's not really going to help us. So the question is, could this Gemara of Kol Hamayv Rodas Balabayas Nikrigalas, and according to Reb Meir, could that possibly provide a model? So you have to figure out what that din is about, and what is Chachamim's view that disagrees, and seems to be different from Tanai, as Abzam Nechemi points out, and he explains it essentially as a concept of shear applicable to rights within an item, and that could be applied to a seller of a book or a tape or a program as well. And others disagreed and said just some broader problems that this was never suggested before him as the approach on why not, and it's so broad it would mean that any seller could tell you when and how you could use the stuff that you buy. And this essentially is not the model for Shear in other contexts. So if that's the case, then we have to figure out how can we maybe answer those questions, or what other possible avenues could there be in terms of addressing intellectual property. So again, we'll resume, God willing, Thursday night. Everyone should have a wonderful 2 days. And we'll see you then. Shkayach.